Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Where exactly does the U.S.-China economic relationship stand? Anyway, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. Wednesday, today, 15 November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. When last we heard from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on this program, it was in the office of the press attaché at the American Embassy in Beijing this past July, her first visit to China as secretary on a trip that was more diplomatic than economic, really. We got to sit down at the end of that trip with the secretary, and here was my, for today's purposes, relevant question.
Last time we spoke, back in March, you were pretty clear that what you're trying to do with the Chinese is establish a floor to this relationship to stop it from getting more destabilized. And I guess my question is, do you think this trip has done that?
And her answer was yes, mostly.
We've grown apart and misunderstandings have developed. And to stabilize our relationship, to put a floor under it and hopefully begin to improve it over time, it's necessary to meet, to discuss our differences openly with respect, and to develop channels of regular communication. And that certainly was a major goal of my trip. I think it was successful in that sense.
All of which I mention as a setup to the news of this day that President Biden and President Xi met this afternoon. Planetary economies, in case you need to be reminded, numbers 1 and 2, looking for that floor.
I think each fears that the relationship could spiral out of control, and there's a number of dimensions on which that can happen.
That's Mary Lovely. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. There are intellectual property protections that are concerns, market access worries on the table as well, also high tech.
We've seen U.S. really tighten its export controls on semiconductors most recently. So for the Chinese side, obviously they would love for the export controls to be removed. We know that's not going to happen.
There's been a lot of corporate governance interventions that really has scared off foreign direct investment. And that is not necessarily good, and definitely not good for just global confidence of the Chinese economy.
Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science and global studies at Temple University.
There seems to be a lot of talking, and in many ways, what we want to see something come out of these communications that both Biden and Xi can take away and bring home.
Again, setting the floor. Also important, by the way, is the relative strengths of the two economies coming into these talks. The United States growing at 4.9% as of the third quarter and doing better overall than any other major economy in the world. China, not.
China is facing an economic slowdown and real estate crisis problems at home. And I think that that incentivizes China for performance legitimacy purposes to be working with the United States and European allies.
Mary Lovely at Peterson gets the last word on China today.
China has all along wanted to reduce tensions with the United States. The question just is at what price?
Geopolitics weren't really much of a factor on Wall Street today. Traders were thinking more economic fundamentals, one of which coming up in a minute. As to all the rest, details, numbers, you know the drill. The economic fundamental du jour is retail sales, which we learned this morning fell in October. That's the first decline in 7 months. We are starting to spend less on all kinds of things American consumers are. Cars, and furniture, building supplies, books, and sports equipment. Target and Home Depot are feeling that pullback. Sales at both fell in the third quarter, particularly, they said, in discretionary categories, which means what exactly? Marketplace's Samantha Fields got today's economic vocabulary assignment.
Most of us buy things we don't really need, at least sometimes. I, for example, got takeout last night because I didn't feel like cooking. David Wessel at the Brookings Institution is going to New York this weekend for work.
But on Saturday evening, I'm going to a Broadway show with my wife.
Both of those are examples of discretionary spending.
Things that you put off if you don't have a lot of money and you spend more on when you have a lot of money.
Put another way,
in the context of consumer spending, discretionary spending are the items you get to choose.
Elaine Mogg at the Tax Policy Center says buying food, for example, is a necessity. But
I can choose whether to purchase a candy bar to go with my dinner, or I can only choose the vegetables.
Buying clothes, also a necessity. But buying new sweaters every year because you're bored of the old ones, discretionary. It seems straightforward. But Luisa Blanco at Pepperdine University says in reality,
it gets a little tricky sometimes to really determine what is discretionary for different people.
Take the holidays and all the money many of us spend buying presents.
If I don't have enough money, that's discretionary, but I am expected, right, to give my kids gifts on Christmas. And that actually creates a lot of stress for a lot of families because it's discretionary spending, but it's not, right?
It's a blurry line. Jonathan Parker at MIT's Sloan School of Management says people who don't have to worry about money often buy things they think of as necessities but really aren't.
When you go to the supermarket, are you buying more prepared foods or are you putting in the work to turn the less expensive foods into dinner yourself? Are you buying the nice cut of steak or are you buying lots of rotisserie chicken?
And he says cutting back on discretionary spending looks different for different people too.
That might be simply moving from a pumpkin spice latte to a plain coffee. It might also be not going out to dinner. It might be going on vacation where you go camping instead of going to a nice hotel.
Or it might mean not buying anything extra at all. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We did a story this past summer about something Jay Powell says all the time.
Monetary policy affects economic activity with long and variable legs.
Famed free market economist Milton Friedman is the guy who made that phrase famous. So we made a couple of calls to understand the origin story and found our way to Jennifer Burns at Stanford.
I am the author of The Last Conservative, Milton Friedman, which will come out in November, but is available now for pre-order.
This being November, that book is now out. So we got Jennifer Burns back on the phone to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let me go to the subtitle of your book first. Why The Last Conservative?
So that's a great question. And it's one I get a lot because Friedman didn't really identify himself as a conservative in his lifetime. But I have two ways in which I think that word is accurate to describe him. So one is, throughout his life, he was not just an academic economist. He was someone who was very close to policymakers, ranging from Barry Goldwater to Richard Nixon to Ronald Reagan. And all of those figures identified their politics as being part of the conservative movement. There's a second reason, though, which is, as an economist, Friedman really made his name by going back to older ideas of economics that the discipline was leaving behind. And he was, in that way, conserving the insights and discoveries of an earlier generation of economists. And the last is really a gesture to the fact that that political synthesis Friedman represented, which was a combination of free market economics, strong national defense, and a global orientation, that synthesis is really coming apart at the seams in our current moment. So I don't actually know that he's the last conservative of that type. I mean, I think there's room for us all to find out, but I think it's a question worth thinking over.
Hold that thought on our current political environment and Milton Friedman, because that's where I want to end. Thank you very much for skipping ahead to the last of my questions. but it also, this idea of him as the last conservative and going back to those values and conserving them, it also made him come off during his lifetime as a little bit of a contrarian, don't you think?
It's true. He was really profoundly out of step politically, intellectually, methodologically with all his peers. And this was a moment when a number of economists with Jewish immigrant backgrounds like him, poured into the academy, really reshaped the field. And they all tended to be politically liberal. And many of them were very much oriented around bringing new mathematical techniques and analyses into economics and making it more quantitative. And Friedman stood against all of this from his earliest days as an economist. And as a result, he was incredibly unpopular, in part because economists thought, well, if it weren't for this guy Friedman, we would all be agreeing on everything and we would have almost unlimited power because we would be able to stand up and in one voice tell politicians and policymakers what to do. And every time they tried to do that, then Friedman would pop up and say, no, they've got it all wrong. And so he really was quite disliked for much of his career.
Let's talk about for a second the things that he is the two things he's most known for now. One is the Chicago School of Economic Thought and Theory, and the other one is this idea of monetarism. And I know I said before we turned on the microphones that I need to keep it high level here, but I do think we need to explain what Milton Friedman was about in economic theory, and that's your job in this interview.
Sure. So I guess I'll start with monetarism. And one easy way to summarize this is by Friedman's famous dictum, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomena. Monetarism really points to the role of money in the economy. And Friedman really developed this idea through the historical studies he did with Anna Schwartz and specifically their analysis of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And they concluded what made the Great Depression great was a loss of one-third of the quantity of money in the United States over the course of the early years. And so they said when you measure an economy's health and activity, this really basic idea, how much money is there in the system, is foundational.
And we should also say here that Friedman and Anna Schwartz, his co-author, about whom we're going to talk in a minute, they basically said the Federal Reserve blew it during the Depression.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting. If inflation is a monetary phenomena, it's also a political and an institutional phenomena because there were people who were supposed to support the quantity of money circulating in the economy. Those people were the Federal Reserve. And so what they should have done is recognize this is a liquidity crisis, flood as much money as they could into the banking system. Coincidentally, actually not coincidentally, this is what policymakers do today,
right.
In large part because they have imbibed this lesson that Friedman and Schwartz discovered that in the Great Depression, these extraordinary measures were not taken, and the result was a decade or longer of economic depression.
More from Jennifer Burns and the life and work of Milton Friedman after the fold. Coming up,
they maybe are not as mobile as an 18 to 22-year-old.
Youth. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 163 today, almost a half percent, 34,991. The NASDAQ added 9 points. That's shy of a tenth percent, 14,103. The S&P 500 picked up 7 points, not quite 0.2%, 45.2 there. Talked about Target a couple of minutes ago. Company expects its holiday season profits to exceed Wall Street expectations. The retailer said its rosy outlook is thanks to lower costs for moving stuff through its supply chains and finally hitting the right level of inventory. We have talked about that a bunch. Target rang up 17.75% today, helped boost the shares of some of its rivals as well. Macy's pocketed 7.5%, Kohl's up 9%. On the other hand, discount retailer TJX, it of TJ Maxx,
Not so great holiday season ahead for them. The owner of TJ Maxx, as I said, Marshalls and Home Goods, cut its profit projection for the holiday quarter. TJX wrote off 3.3%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note 4.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Jennifer Burns, her book about Milton Friedman, part two. Here you go. I mentioned Anna Schwartz a minute ago, also his wife, Rose. He owes, and he kind of acknowledged it, but kind of, you know, rode their coattails, as it were, the role of women in his life and how they helped him in his work. They were critical.
Yeah, absolutely. So at every major publication, Friedman was working closely with a co-author or collaborator who was a woman. So the most obvious is A Monetary History of the United States, because Schwartz was a co-author, although she really had to fight and Friedman had to fight behind the scenes for her to get proper credit for that book. But one of his technical works of economics, A Theory of the Consumption Function, what I uncovered in my research is this group of women economists who studied consumption and who talked with Friedman about their ideas and their findings during summer vacations. And over the years, these conversations grew more and more robust, more and more important to him. And eventually he wrote them up in a paper that then turned into the book. And so that was basically a way for women at a time when economics as a discipline wouldn't really recognize their contribution. They almost planted their ideas with Friedman, right, and, you know, saw them prosper and grow there.
It's you talk about this in the book a little bit, the whole idea of home economics.
That's right. Well, it's a great irony because women were considered to have expertise in buying, selling, shopping, these types of things. And so those were kind of left aside. That was women's work. And over the course of the 20th century, how to support consumption, which is an essential part of demand, became really important to the political system and the economics profession. And so the people who knew the most about actual consumption, how real people, real families made these decisions, were these women researchers who were often in low prestige, low pay jobs. And Friedman figured out how to use their findings and how to think the way they did. And then because he was a tenured professor, he was able to package these ideas in a way that really caught the attention of the broader profession.
I want to talk about Milton Friedman, the, as you call him in the book, the political figurehead, his alignment with Goldwater and Nixon and Reagan, and now you progress through the Republican Party of today. I wonder two things about Friedman if he comes back. He dies in 2006. He comes back today and he looks around, number one, at the conservative, the nominally conservative party in this country. What does he think?
So one way to think about that is to understand that throughout his life, he saw himself as fighting a countercurrent in Republican politics and a conservative movement, a populist and conspiratorially minded conservative. So this started in the 1950s when he saw himself as fighting what he called the McCarthy-McCormick wing. That was Joe McCarthy, the anti-communist senator, and Robert McCormick, the head of the isolationist, the publisher of the isolationist Chicago Tribune. So those were, to him, he called them sometimes the crackpot conservatives of the radical fringe. And that was who he was hoping to displace. So I think he would see, you know, the current state of play today is this is an old tendency. This is something that happens over and over again. And we can't give in to the more populist and conspiratorially minded trends. We have to provide a better alternative.
And then the management of this economy today. I mean, Jay Powell, for crying out loud, I don't know if you watch his press conferences every whatever it is, 6 weeks, but pretty much every time Powell talks about the long and variable lag of monetary policy. And Joe Biden in the 2020 campaign said Milton Friedman's not in charge anymore. I mean, he's still a presence in the management of this economy 15 years after he died, almost 20 now.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And just, you know, going back to my title, The Last Conservative, there's a way in which he's the last conservative because his ideas have become very important to liberals and to Democrats. And they've kind of marked out a centrist liberalism that, you know, is now under attack from a more progressively oriented members of the party. So, you know, I think when Joe Biden talks about Milton Friedman, it's kind of gesturing to that divide within the Democratic Party. In terms of Jay Powell, I think that as inflation has emerged, Friedman has become an important figure because he was really part of the first effort to tackle the great inflation in the 1970s. And so to talk about Friedman is to signal a certain position and to sort of call on his prestige and his credentials.
When you look around in this economy today, what signs of Milton Friedman do you still see in policies or programs?
So, beyond the inflation debate, I think it's really interesting how pandemic relief was structured. It was really structured along the lines of the earned income tax credit, whether it was a child tax care credit or some of the more direct relief. And this is what Friedman had been calling for most of his lifetime. And so I think that model of policy has become very ingrained and become very natural. And it was not at all in his day. So that's one thing I see.
This is, with all possible respect, this is a tome. It is not light reading, as much as I enjoyed it. But what do you want people to know about Milton Friedman? And I'm going to ask you to answer that in like 45 seconds. And yes, you wrote a 450-page book on the guy. But what's it important for people to know about this guy?
What I really want them to know is that the Friedman you might see on YouTube or hear about, you know, the last things he said in the 90s and the 80s is not the full Friedman. And you really have to understand the young Friedman and the Friedman who lived through the Great Depression, lived through World War II, lived through the crisis of stagflation, and that his ideas really respond to those historical moments, and that whether we agree with the conclusions he came to or not, we have a model of somebody thinking through his times and doing his best to use the intellectual tools and capacities he has to propose new solutions and new ideas.
It's a book called Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative. Jennifer Burns at Stanford wrote it. Professor Burns, thanks for your time. I appreciate it and I enjoyed the book.
Thanks so much.
This may raise some eyebrows, but higher education in the United States is a business. Not for profit, for the most part, but a business nonetheless. And like those for-profit businesses, colleges and universities here have to keep an eye on the basics, expenses and revenues. International students are a major source of the latter. And when a lot of those students headed back home in the pandemic, schools felt it in their bottom lines. They're coming back, though, those students, slowly. Though a million foreign students in the 22-23 school year, according to data from the State Department and the Institute of International Education, that's up 12% over the prior academic year, still, though, below the pre-pandemic peak. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, where those students are coming from and what they're willing to pay is changing.
More students come to the U.S. for higher education from China than anywhere else. But the number of Chinese students studying here dropped for the third year in a row. And the number of undergraduate and non-degree-seeking students has gone down by about a third since its peak. Chris R. Glass studies higher education as a professor at Boston College.
China really underperformed. If this was Wall Street and we saw these numbers from China, the stock would plummet.
Glass notes more Chinese students are studying at home.
Parents see unaffordable tuition and incidents of gun violence and racism on the news, they're much more hesitant to send their child to a U.S. institution.
Students coming from other parts of the world have made up for a good chunk of that decline. Sub-Saharan African countries sent 18% more students last year. India sent 35% more. Mirka Martel of the Institute of International Education says these areas have lots of young people.
But there is not often home country capacity to satisfy those students.
The impact those students have on a college or university's bottom line depends on whether they're undergrads paying thousands of dollars annually in tuition or graduate students getting stipends. India, for example, sent about five times as many grad students as undergrads. Chris R. Glass of Boston College says the revenue implications are significant.
Our mid-tier public institutions, our regional institutions, our community colleges, all are going to see their balance sheets change as a result of these underlying dynamics.
Schools can boost international enrollment with online education. Stephanie Kim of Georgetown points out it reaches a different demographic.
And they're typically older adults. They maybe are not as mobile as an 18 to 22-year-old picking up, moving to the United States.
And you can fit way more students in a virtual classroom than in a lecture hall. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, make of this what you will if you're running a company that's still undecided on the whole getting people back to the office thing. Saw this on Bloomberg that companies that allow fully remote work have revenue growth four times faster than those who require in-office presence. Fully flexible companies, which are either completely remote or let people decide when to come to the office, saw a 21% increase in sales between 2020 and 2022. Hybrid or fully in-the-office companies, 5%. All right, we're going to go here, though, your moment of economic context. Another inflation data point to add to the calculations. Prices at the wholesale level, we learned this morning, down a half a percentage point in October. That is the biggest drop in 3.5 years. Year on year, producer prices, as they're known, up 1.3%. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostet, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, One Call Us Toronto, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.